Hugo Kramer watched the aircraft through his binoculars, balancing easily against the roll and pitch of the bridge.
"Police patrol?" asked the man at the helm beside him.
"No," Hugo replied, without lowering his glasses.
"Red and white twin Beechcraft, registration ZSPTB, private aircraft, probably one of the diamond companies."
He lowered the glasses and crossed to the wing of the bridge.
"Anyway, we are well outside territorial waters."
The drone of the aircraft engine faded away, and Hugo transferred his attention to the frantic activity on the deck below him. The trawler, Wild Goose, lay heeled over under the weight of fish that filled her purse-seine net. At least 100 tons of seething silver pilchards bulging the net out alongside the trawler into a round bag 50 feet across, while above it a shrieking canopy of seabirds swirled and wheeled and dived, frantic with greed. Three of the crew on the scoop net, which hung from the overhead derrick, were dipping the fish out of the net, swinging a ton of fish at each scoop over the side and dropping them like a silver cloudburst into the trawler's hold. The donkey engine on the winch clattered harshly in time to their movements. Hugo watched with satisfaction. He had a good crew, and although the fishing was only a cover for the Wild Goose, yet Hugo took pride in his Teutonic thoroughness, which dictated that the cover should be as solid as possible. In any case, all profits from fishing were for his personal account. It was part of the agreement with the ring. He packed the binoculars carefully into their leather case and hung them behind the chartroom door. Then he clambered swiftly down the steel ladder to deck level, moving with cat-like grace despite the heavy rubber hip boots he wore. "I'll take her here for a while," he told the man at the winch controls. He spoke in Afrikaans, but his accent was shaded with the German of Southwest Africa. Wide-shouldered under the blue fisherman's jersey, he worked with smooth economic movements. His hands on the winch control were rough and reddened by wind and sun, for his skin was too fair to weather. The skin of his face was also red and half-boiled, peeling so there were pinky raw places on his cheeks and black scabs on his lips. The hair that hung out under his cap was white as bleached sisal, and his eyelashes were thick and colourless, giving him a mild, near-sighted look. His eyes were the palest of cornflower blue, yet without being weak and watery as those of most albinos. They were slitted now, as he judged the roll and dip of the boat, engaging the clutch to meet the movement, or pulling on the drum brake.
"Skipper!"
a shout from the bridge above him.
"Yeah?"
Hugo did not allow his attention to waver as he replied.
"What is it?" "Gale warning. There's a northerly bluster building up."
And Hugo grinned, pulled on the brake and shut the throttle.
"Yeah, all right, clean up. Cuts a purse rope, lets a fish go free."
He turned and swarmed up the ladder to the bridge and went to his chart table.
"It will take us 3 hours to get in position,"
he muttered aloud, leaning over the chart. Then he barged out onto the wing of the bridge again to chase up his crew. They had cut the purse rope and the net, allowing the net to fall open like a woman's skirt, and the fish were pouring out, a dark, spreading stain through the gap. Two men had the pressure hose on, washing loose fish from the deck into the sea. Others were slamming the hatch covers closed. Within 40 minutes, Wild Goose was running south under full throttle to take up her waiting station. The diamond coast of Southwest Africa lies in the belt of the trades. The prevailing wind is the southeaster, but periodically the wind system is completely reversed and a gale comes out of the north, off the land. It is a Sirocco-type wind like the Khamzin of the Libyan desert or the Simoom of Tripoli. It was the same searing dry wind out of the desert, filling the sky with brooding dust and sand clouds, smothering everything beneath a hellish pall like the smoke from a great battlefield. The dust clouds were part of the design. The ring had taken account of them when they planned the system, for the north wind lifted into the sky such a quantity of mica dust that the radar screens of the Diamond Security Police were cluttered and confused, throwing up phantom echoes and making it impossible to pick up the presence of a small airborne object. Turnback Point was 3 miles inland and 60 miles north of the Orange River. The name was given by the first travellers and expressed their views on continuing a journey northwards. Those old travellers had not known that they stood in the centre of an elevated marine terrace, an ancient beach now lifted above the level of the sea, and that it was the richest prospect of an area so diamond-rich that it was to be ring-fenced, patrolled by jeep and dog and aircraft, guarded by gun and radar, a lager so secure that a man leaving it would have to submit to X-ray and take nothing out with him but the clothes he wore. At Turnback Point was one of the four big separation plants where all the gravel from the big company's workings from miles around was processed. The settlement was comparatively large, with plant, workshops and stores, and accommodation for 500 men and their families. Yet not all the company's efforts to make it attractive and livable could alter the fact that Turnback Point was a hellhole in a savage and forbidding desert. Now, with the north wind blowing, what had been unpleasant before was almost unbearable. The buildings were tightly sealed. Even the joints around the windows and doors were plugged with cloth or paper, and yet the red dust seeped in to powder the furniture, the desks, the bed linen, even the interior of the refrigerators with a thin, gritty film. It settled in the hair, was sugary between the teeth, clogged the nostrils, and with it came that searing heat that seemed to dry the moisture from the eyeballs. Outside, the dust was a red, glittering fog, which reduced visibility to a dozen yards. Men who were forced out into that choking dry soup wore dust goggles to protect their eyes, and the mica dust covered their clothing with a shiny coating that glittered even in that dun light. Beyond the settlement, a man moved now through the fog, carrying a small cylindrical object. He leaned forward into the wind, moving slowly away into the desert. He reached a shallow depression and went down into it. Setting his burden on the sand, he rested a moment. Then he knelt over the cylinder. He appeared monstrous under his leather jacket and cap, his face covered by goggles and scarf. The fiberglass cylinder was painted with yellow fluorescent paint. At one end was a transparent plastic bubble, which housed an electric globe. At the other end was a folded envelope of rubberized nylon material attached to the cylinder by a stainless steel coupling, and linked to the coupling was a small steel bottle of hydrogen gas. The whole assembly was 18 inches long and 3 inches in diameter. It weighed a few ounces more than 15 pounds. Within the cylinder were two separate compartments. The larger contained a highly sophisticated piece of transistorized electronic equipment which would transmit a homing signal, light or extinguish its lamp on long-distance radio signal command, and also at command it would control the inflow of hydrogen gas into the nylon balloon through the connecting coupling. The smaller compartment held simply a sealed plastic container, into which were packed 27 diamonds. The smallest of these stones weighed 14 carats, the largest a formidable 56 carats. Each of these stones had been selected by experts for colour, brilliance and perfection. These were all first water diamonds, and once they were cut, they would fetch in the open market between 700,000 and £1 million, depending on the skill of the cutting. There were four members of the ring at Turnback Point. Two of them were long-service and trusted diamond sorters employed behind the guarded walls of the processing plant. They worked together to check each other, for the company operated a system of employee double-check, which was completely useless when there was collusion. These men selected the finest stones and got them out of the plant. The third member of the ring was a diesel mechanic in the company workshops. It was his job to receive and assemble the equipment which arrived concealed in a marked drum of tractor grease. He also packed the stones into the cylinder and passed it on to the man who was now kneeling out in the desert, preparing to launch the cylinder into the swirling dust fog. His final check completed, the man stood up and went to the lip of the depression and peered out into the dust storm. At last he seemed satisfied and hurried back to the yellow cylinder. With an incisive twist of the beveled release ring, he opened the valve on the bottle of hydrogen gas. There was a snake-like hiss, and the nylon balloon began to inflate. The folds of the material crackled as they filled. The balloon lifted, eager to be gone, but the man restrained it with difficulty until the balloon was smooth and tight. He let go, and the balloon with its dangling cylinder leapt into the sky and almost instantly was gone into the dust clouds. The man stood with his face lifted to the dark furnace-red sky. His goggles glinted blindly, but his attitude was one of triumph, and when he turned away, he walked lightly with the step of a man freshly released from danger. "One more package," he promised himself. "Just one more, and I'll pull out. Buy that farm on the Olifants River and do a bit of fishing. Take a shooting trip every year." He was still dreaming when he reached the parked Land Rover and climbed into the driver's seat. He started the engine, switched on the headlights, and drove slowly down the track towards the settlement. The sign on the rear of the departing Land Rover was in white-red paint, so that it showed clearly through the haze of red dust. "Security Patrol," it read. Wild Goose lay on station, with her diesels throbbing softly, ticking over to hold her head into the wind. Even 20 miles out at sea, the wind was searing hot, and the occasional splatter of spray on Hugo's face was refreshing. He stood in the corner of the bridge where he could watch the sea and the helmsman. But he was anxious. Wild Goose had been lying on station for 15 hours now, during 10 of which the norther had howled dismally through her rigging. He was always anxious at the beginning of a pickup. There was so much that could have gone wrong, anything from a police sweep to a tiny electrical fault in the equipment. "What time is it, Hansi?" he shouted, and the helmsman glanced up at the chronometer above his head. 3 minutes after 6, skipper." "Dark in half an hour," Hugo grunted disgustedly, slitted those pale-lashed eyes into the wind once more, then shrugged and ambled back into the bridge house. He stopped at the console beside his chart table. Even to an experienced eye, the machine was an ordinary fish finder, an adaptation of the old wartime anti-submarine device, the ASDIC, to the more prosaic business of plotting the depth and position of the pilchard shoals beneath the surface. However, this model had undergone a costly and specialized conversion. The Ring had flown an expert out from Japan to do the work. Now that the set hummed softly, its control panel lit soft green by the internal light, but the sound was neutral, and the circular glass screen was blank. "You want some coffee, Hansi?" Hugo asked the old coloured man at the wheel. His crew were hand-picked, loyal and trusted. They had to be. One loudmouth could blow a multi-million-pound business. "Ja, donkey skipper." The old man creased his weathered, battered face in appreciation, and Hugo shouted down the companionway to the galley, "Cookie, how's it for a pot of coffee?" But the reply was lost, for at that moment the console came to life dramatically. A row of lights blinked on above the control panel. The muted hum changed to a rapid beep-beep signal, and the screen glowed ghostly green. "She's up!" Hugo shouted his relief, and ran to the set. His first mate rushed through from his cabin behind the bridge, tucking his shirt into unbuttoned trousers, his face puckered with sleep. "Bad bloody time," he blurted groggily. "Take over from Hansi," Hugo told him, and he settled into the padded seat in front of the ASDIC set. "Right, bring her round 2 points to port and open her up." The Wild Goose swung her head into the sea, and her motion changed from easy swoop and glide to a crabbing, butting lunge, and the spray burst over the glass of the bridge. Sitting before the console, Hugo was tracking the flight of the balloon and keeping Wild Goose on an interception course. Driven by the 40-knot norther, the balloon crossed the coastline, climbing swiftly to 3,000 feet. Hugo manipulated the knob on the console, which sent the balloon a command to release gas and maintain altitude. Her response was recorded immediately on the screen. "Ah, good," Hugo whispered. "Good girl." Then louder, "Bring her round a bit, Oscar. The balloon is drifting to the south." For 20 minutes more, they butted through the swells. "Okay," Hugo broke the silence. "I'm going to ditch her." He twisted the knob clockwise slowly, expelling all the gas from the nylon balloon. "Yeah, that's it. She's down." He looked out of the window above the set. The dust-laden clouds had brought the night on prematurely. It was dark outside, with a low black ceiling through which no star showed. Hugo turned his attention back to the set. "That's it, Oscar. You're right on course. Hold her there." Then he glanced across at old Hansi and another younger crewman. They were sitting patiently on the bench against the far bulkhead. Both of them were clad in full oilskins, shiny yellow plastic from head to ankle, with gumboots below that.
"Okay, Hansi," Hugo nodded. "You can get up in the bows. We are only a mile or so away now."
They climbed down on the wave-swept deck, and Hugo watched them scuttling forward between each green burst of water and crouching in the bows, both of them ducking each time another swell poured over the top of them, their yellow plastic suits showing clearly in the murky deck lights.
"I am going to switch her on now," Hugo warned the helm. "We should have her visual."
"Right," Oscar peered ahead, and Hugo flicked a switch on the panel, commanding the balloon to turn on her guide light. Almost immediately there was a shout from Oscar.
"There she is, dead ahead!"
Hugo jumped up and ran forward. It took a few seconds for his eyes to adjust. Then he made out the tiny red firefly of light ahead of them in the vast blackness of sea and sky. It showed for a second, then was gone in the trough of the next wave.
"I'll take her," Hugo replaced Oscar at the wheel. "You get on the spotlight."
The beam of the spotlight was a solid white shaft through the darkness. The fluorescent yellow paint of the cylinder glowed in the circle of the spot. Hugo lay wild goose upwind of the cylinder, and then allowed her to drift down gently on it. Hansi and his assistant were ready with the 20-foot boat hook. Delicately, Hugo manoeuvred down over the bobbing yellow cylinder and grunted with satisfaction as the boat hook slipped through the recovery ring and the cylinder was hauled in over the bows. He watched while the two dripping, oilskin-clad figures clambered back up the ladder into the wheelhouse and laid the cylinder on the chart table.
"Good, good," Hugo slapped their backs heartily. "Now, go and get dry, both of you."
They climbed down the companionway, and Hugo handed the wheel over to Oscar.
"Home," he instructed him, "as quick as you like."
And he carried the cylinder through into his cabin. Sitting at the fold-down table in his cabin, Hugo unscrewed the lower section of the cylinder and took out the plastic container. He opened it and spilled the contents out on the tabletop. He whistled softly and picked up the biggest stone. Although he was no expert, he knew instinctively that it was a brilliant of exceptional quality. Even the roughness of its exterior could not mask the fire in its depths. To him it was worthless. There was nowhere he could market a stone like that. There was no temptation to take it out of the ring. All it would mean for him was 15 years at hard labour. The ring was based on this mutual reliance. No one part of it could function without all the others. Yet each part was self-contained and watertight. Only one man knew all its parts, and nobody knew who that man was. From the drawer beside him, Hugo took out his tools and set them on the table. He lit the spirit stove and set the pot of paraffin wax in the gimbal above it to heat. Then he poured the diamonds into a shiny metal can. It was the type of ordinary commercial can used for packing and preserving foodstuffs. Balancing against the ship's motion, he lifted the pot from the stove and poured the steaming liquid wax over the diamonds, filling the can to rim level. The wax cooled and solidified quickly, turning opaque and white. The stones were now incorporated in a cake of wax that would prevent them rattling and would give the sealed can authentic weight. Hugo lit a cigarette and crossed the cabin to look out into the wheelhouse. The helmsman winked at him, and Hugo smiled. He went back to the table. The can was cool enough to handle. He placed the circular lid over it and moved to the portable jenny bolted to a chest of drawers. Carefully, he clinched the lid into place, his eyes squinting at the smoke from the cigarette that dangled from his lips. Satisfied at last, he set the sealed can on the table while he went to where his jacket hung on the door. From the inside pocket, he pulled out a manila envelope. Then from the envelope, he drew a printed, colour-screened label. He came back to the bench and meticulously pasted the label around the can. On the label was a highly glamorized artist's conception of a leaping pilchard, making it look like a Scottish salmon. "Pilchards in tomato sauce," Hugo read the label aloud, as he leaned back to admire his work.
a product of Southwest Africa. He smiled with satisfaction and began packing his equipment away.
How much?
The foreman of the fish pump called across the narrowing gap between Wild Goose and the jetty.
About 50 tons, Hugo shouted back. Then the Norther chased us home.
Yeah, none of the boats stayed out. The foreman watched his gang secure the mooring ropes and swing the hose of the vacuum pump over Wild Goose's hold to begin pumping out her pilchards.
Take over, Oscar. Hugo picked up his jacket and cap. I will be back tomorrow.
He jumped down onto the jetty and strode down towards the canning factory with its awesome stink of pilchard oil. His jacket was slung over his shoulder, one finger hooked through the tag. He went down an alley between the boiler rooms and the fish-drying plant, across a wide yard where the bags of fish meal were piled to the height of a double-story building. He turned in through the double doors of the cavernous warehouse, filled to roof height with cardboard cartons, each stenciled with the words, "One gross cans consigned to Pilchards in Tomato Sauce, VDB Agencies Limited, 32 Bermondsey Street, London, SE1. He went into the cubicle that served the warehouse storeman as an office.
"Hello, Hugo. Good trip."
The storeman was Hugo's brother-in-law.
50 ton.
Hugo hung his coat casually on the hook behind the door.
"I have got to take a leak," he said,
and went to the latrine across the floor of the warehouse.
He came back and drank a cup of tea with his brother-in-law. Then he stood and said, "Jeannie will be waiting. Give her my love."
"She don't need yours. She's going to get plenty off mine." Hugo winked and took his coat from the hook. It was lighter now. The can was gone from the pocket. He went through the main gates of the harbour, exchanging a casual greeting with the customs officer, and went to the battered early model convertible in the car park. He kissed the girl at the driving wheel, threw his coat on the back seat, and climbed in over the door.
"You drive," he told her, grinning. "I want both hands free."
She squeaked and pulled his hand out of her skirts.
"Can't you wait till we get home? I've been at sea for 5 days. I'm hungry as hell."
"You're a caution, you are," she laughed at him and started the car. This was Sergio Caporetti, the man Johnny had chosen to Captain Kingfisher. He was a round man, the same shape as a snowman. He filled the doorway of Johnny's office, and his great belly bulging into the room ahead of him. His face was round also, like a baby's, but he had beautiful dark Italian eyes, fringed with thick lashes like a girl's.
"Come in, Sergio," Johnny greeted him. "Nice to see you."
The Italian crossed the room deceptively quickly, and Johnny's hand was completely engulfed by the enormous hairy paw.
"So at last we are ready," Sergio grunted. 3 months I sit on bum. Do nothing. Look at me."
He slapped his belly with a sound like a pistol shot.
"Ha! Fat! No good!"
"Well, not quite ready," Johnny qualified the statement. He was flying Sergio and his crew over to England well ahead of time. He wanted the big Italian to have plenty of opportunity to study and get to know the revolutionary new equipment with which Kingfisher was fitted. Then, when the vessel was ready for sea, Sergio would sail her out to Africa.
"Sit down, Sergio. Let's go over the crew list."
When Sergio left an hour later, Johnny went as far as the lift with him.
"If you have any problems, phone me, Sergio."
"Si." Sergio shook hands.
"Don't worry. Caporetti is in charge. All is well."
On his way back, Johnny stopped at the reception desk.
"Is Mrs. Hartford in today?"
he asked one of the little receptionists, and both of them replied in chorus like Tweedledum and Tweedledee.
"No, Mr. Lance."
"Has she phoned to say where she is?"
"No, Mr. Lance."
Tracy had disappeared. 5 days now, there had been no sign of her. Her new office was deserted and unused. Johnny was worried and angry. He was worried that she had gone on another binge, and he was angry because he missed her. He was scowling ferociously as he went back into his office.
"Goodness me," Letty Pienaar stood beside his desk with a batch of mail in her hand. "We do look happy. Here's something to cheer you up."
She handed him a postcard with a colour picture of the Eiffel Tower. It was the first word from Ruby since she had left. Johnny read it quickly.
"Paris," he said, "is fun, it seems."
He tossed the card onto the desk and plunged back into the day's work.
He worked late, stopped at a steakhouse to eat, then drove back to the silent house in Bishop's Court. The crunch of tyres on the gravel drive and headlights flashing across the bedroom wall woke him. He sat up in bed as the front doorbell began a series of urgent peals, and he switched on the bedside light. 2 o'clock, Christ! He pulled a dressing gown over his nudity and tottered down the passage, switching on lights as he went. The doorbell kept ringing. He turned the front door key. The door flew open and Tracy came in like a strong wind, clutching a briefcase to her chest. "Where the hell have you been?" Johnny was suddenly fully awake, angry and relieved. "Johnny! Johnny!" She was dancing with excitement. Incoherent, her cheeks flaming and eyes shining. "I've got them! At least it! Both of them!" "Where have you been?" Johnny was not to be so easily sidetracked, and with an obvious effort, Tracy brought her excitement under control. But she was still smiling and gave the impression of humming like an electric motor. "Come!" She took his hand and dragged him into the lounge. "Get yourself a large whiskey and sit down," she ordered, imperious as a queen. "I don't want a whiskey, and I don't..." "You'll need one," she interrupted, and went to the open liquor cabinet, poured a mass of whiskey into a crystal glass, squirted soda into it, and brought it back to Johnny. "Tracy, what the hell is going on?"
"Please, Johnny, it's so wonderful. Don't spoil it for me. Just sit there, please."
Johnny sank reluctantly into the chair, and Tracy slipped the catch on her briefcase and drew out a sheaf of documents. She stood in the centre of the floor and took up the pose of a Victorian actress. "This," she explained, "is a translation from the original German of a proclamation by Governor in Council dated the 3rd of May, 1899, and issued at Windhoek. I'll leave out the preamble and go straight to the meat." She cleared her throat and began reading. "In consideration of the sum of 10,000 marks, which is hereby paid and received, the rights to mine, win, recover, collect or carry away all metals, whether base or precious, stones, whether base, semi-precious or precious, minerals, guano, vegetation and other substances, organic or inorganic, for a period of 999 years, is granted to Messrs. Farben, Hendrick and Mosenthal, S.A., guano merchants of 14 Bergenstrasse, Windhoek, in respect of a circular area 10 kilometres in radius, whose centre shall be a point situate at the highest elevation of the island, lying on latitude 23 degrees 15 minutes south and longitude 15 degrees 12 minutes east." Tracy paused and looked at Johnny. He was frozen, stony-faced, staring at her with all his attention. She went on quickly, gabbling it out. "All the old German mineral concessions and rights were ratified by the Union Parliament when the Union of South Africa took over the mandate after the Great War." He nodded, unable to speak. Tracy's smile kept breaking out. "That concession still has all the force of law behind it. The grant of any subsequent rights is invalid. And although the original grant was mainly for the recovery of guano, yet it covers precious stones also." Again, Johnny nodded, and Tracy put the document at the bottom of the sheaf of papers in her hand. "The concession company, Farben, Hendrick and Mosenthal, S.A., is still in existence. The company's only remaining asset, apart from any long-forgotten concessions, is an old building at 14 Bergenstrasse, Windhoek." Tracy seemed to change the subject suddenly. "You ask me where I've been, Johnny. Well, I've been to Windhoek, and over most of the worst roads in southwest Africa. The Farben, Hendrick and Mosenthal Company is owned by the brothers Hendrick, a couple of Karakul fur farmers. They're a pair of horrible old men, and when I saw them slitting the throats of those poor little Persian lambs, just to prevent the fur uncurling, well..." Tracy paused and gulped. "Well, I didn't explain to them about the concession. I just offered to buy the company, and they asked 20,000, and I said sign. And they signed, and I left them chuckling with glee. They thought they'd been terribly clever. There, it's all yours." Tracy handed the agreement to Johnny, and while he read it, she went on. "I made the agreement in the name of Van der Bale Diamonds. I signed it as a director. I hope you won't mind." "Christ!" Johnny took a long, deep swallow of whiskey, then set the glass down and stood up. "Mind?" he repeated. "You bring me the concession to Thunderbolt and Suicide and ask me if I mind?" He reached for her, and eagerly she went to him. "Tracy, you're wonderful." They hugged each other ecstatically, and Johnny swung her off her feet. Without either of them planning it, They were suddenly lying still in each other's arms on the couch. Then they were kissing, and the laughter dwindled into small murmurs of incoherent sounds. Tracy pulled away from him at last and slipped off the couch. She stood in the centre of the floor. Her breathing was ragged. Her hair was a dark tangle.
"Whoa, whoa, whoa, that's enough."
"Tracy." He started up from the couch, wild for her. But she held him at the full stretch of her arms, her hands flat on his chest, backing away in front of him.
"No, Johnny, no."
She shook her head urgently. "Listen to me." He stopped. The wild look faded from his eyes.
"Look, Johnny, God knows I'm no saint, but,
well, I don't want us to. Well, not on a couch in some other woman's house. That's not how I want it to be."